Sometimes politics and opinions can end up distracting from the facts. Get to the meat of the issue.
The Two Redheads is a podcast analysing the facts and party lines around issues facing the New Zealand public today.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of The Two Redheads. I'm Josh and this is Richard.
Good to be back, guys. Good to be back.
You're damn right it is. Today we're going to look at euthanasia and the upcoming referendum this winter, I guess it is, in New Zealand.
September, that's the one.
So, Richard, just run us down the bill and how we got to this stage of proceedings.
Yeah, so how we got to this stage, you'll probably all be aware that your boy, ACT MP David Seymour, is the reason this has come to fruition. The euthanasia kind of topic's been tried to be passed a couple of years leading up till now, I think 90-something and 2004. Both times didn't get through. Slimly didn't get through, actually. And here we are today where we've had this bill go through 69 in favour and 51 opposed. So what's going to happen? You're going to get asked in your referendum, do you support the end-of-life choice bill coming into force? Yes, I support it. No, I don't. Simple, Josh?
Pretty simple. Just like last time with the cannabis, I don't think there can be much confusion. I think it is worth noting how we got to a referendum, though, Richard, because really, you would think that we wouldn't have to have a referendum on this.
I totally agree, man. That's the whole reason we have representative MPs in Parliament. We vote on them and then they pass legislation through. So the reason it got to a referendum is essentially NZ First. I don't think they were in favour of voting through the bill unless it got put through as a referendum. And they kind of tied the hands of Green MPs, or tied the hands of David Seymour, Green MPs and Labour MPs that were all voting for it.
Absolutely. Just a note that this is more of a personal choice than a political choice, right, as well.
You're totally right. So yeah, if I just scroll down. With this, you've got Labour MPs voting against, National MPs voting against, National MPs voting for, Labour MPs voting for. So it's, yeah, it's a conscience vote based on your kind of personal decision as to the matter.
Almost a more representative vote in a way.
Yeah, that's the one. So yeah, the crux of the bill is that it gives terminally ill individuals the option of assisted dying. So this can entail either the nurse giving them medication to relieve their suffering or them taking it themselves. Can be both. So I'll just list off all the criteria under Section 4 of the Act. And when I first read this, my first thoughts were, actually, that's a lot of conditions, Josh. I'll read you and then we'll kind of talk them over. Yeah. So over 18, have to be a citizen or resident. You have to suffer from a terminal illness that's likely to end their life within 6 months. Have significant ongoing decline in physical capability. Experience unbearable suffering that cannot be eased. And finally, very important when you're looking at dementia patients and very old individuals, is be able to make an informed decision about assisted dying. So yeah, quite a bit of criteria there, my man.
Yes, a lot. And I was looking at that before as well. It's like, because they had to make compromises, didn't they, in the readings? And one of those was just making it the last 6 months if you're a terminally ill patient. I think just before we get into that, it's very important to define the difference between euthanasia, assisted suicide, and assisted dying, just so we can get a picture of what each one is. And I have a quote here by Richard Huxtable, Professor of Medical Ethics and Law at the University of Bristol, who says the main difference between euthanasia and assisted suicide is who performs the final fatal act. Euthanasia refers to active steps taken to end someone's life to stop their suffering, and the final deed is undertaken by someone other than the individual, for example, a doctor. If the person concerned has requested this, it falls under the term voluntary euthanasia, which is another extension. Assisted suicide, on the other hand, is about helping someone to take their own life at their request. In other words, the final deed is undertaken by the person themselves. Assisted dying can be used to mean both euthanasia, generally voluntary, and assisted suicide. But however, some campaigns groups use it to refer only to assisted suicide of terminally ill people. I think this is, yeah.
Yeah, so my question straight off the back of that is, what would you fit this category into? Because obviously you have the option to get the nurse to give you the medication and you can actually take it yourself, either or.
Yes.
I suppose that means
I would definitely classify it as assisted dying.
Assisted dying, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So previous, or straight off the point of that, we were saying that there's that criteria, terminal illness within 6 months. It is probably important to note that up until, and you mentioned this, up until the second reading, it was just a grievous and irremediable medical condition to request assisted dying. But really interestingly, this kind of came through in the second reading, so select committee, a lot of stern opposition from disability groups who said the bill would allow the disabled to be coerced into death if that was the condition. And actually, you might find this interesting, Joshy, the Green MPs wouldn't vote for it unless that condition was changed. It was a big opposition from the Green Party on that front. So yeah, so David Seymour strictly kind of disagreed with that front, but he needed those Green MPs to get it through, so obviously changed that. And the final thing I'll mention about the bill is, or two actually, under Section 18B, there's no further action to be had if a nurse suspects any form of pressure. So the minute a doctor or a nurse suspects pressure from any individual other than the individual concerned, they pretty much have to pull the pin under this provision. They have to stop the process.
Yeah, interesting, but I think a sound provision. I think that it makes sense. And if we, when we go to look at other countries, we can see that there are similar things that come up and sprop up in these other policies.
Yeah. And just so I can quickly move us on from this, informed decision under Section 4A, what that entails is that the person understands the information. They retain that information necessary to the extent necessary, which is, again, relevant for very elderly and dementia patients who might have made the decision and pulled back on it. It gets a bit tricky. They've been able to use or weigh that information, and they've communicated that decision in some way. So that's what an informed decision means, and we know that's one of the requirements. Well, why don't we talk over those pros and cons? You mentioned slippery slope. Do you want to start us off, my man?
Sure. So I know that you have brought this up in conversation with me quite often in the past, and that reference to Bill English made a interesting speech on this a couple of years ago in regards to the slippery slope, that you have the opinion summed it up quite well.
Yeah, no, so Bill English spoke in the first reading pretty strongly. So this is in 2017 when he was still in the National Party. Spoke pretty strongly about why he didn't want to see this come to fruition. And essentially, he went for the standard argument, which is because we don't want people encouraging a depressed, disabled young person to think their life isn't worth anything. So the slippery slope kind of comes down to the fact that euthanasia laws, as they progressively become liberalized, are said to make individuals think their life is worth less than others, right?
Yeah, and I guess it also, that extends to people with like inherent disabilities, whatever, because then there is stuff like literally provisions in liberal euthanasia laws that could say this could warrant euthanasia, which devalues their life, like in law. And that is definitely a slippery slope to euthanasia, eugenics, or whatever you want to label it. But it's nothing which has a nice connotation or a positive outlook.
Yeah, so as you see, you get conditions which are generally vulnerable people in life, someone with illnesses, someone with mental health issues, blah, blah, blah. If the stuff's written down on legislation, they look at it, they meet that criteria, suddenly they're, you know, subject to that ability of having their life taken. And it does make you question, oh, am I being a burden on my family by being alive right now?
Yeah, which I think is, when you were saying before, this last 6 months of terminally ill, no pressure, these are all weighing into trying to compensate for these things and not make it so that it sounds like this, yeah.
And straight off the bat, like, I mean, I would have questioned that 6 month thing at the forefront, but I think maybe that's a good condition right there. Another con, most people that deny patients a legal right of assisted dying rely on a premise that doing so undermines the sanctity of life. So it's a big religious argument, but you know, is that kind of whole concept that you have the right to live and you're taking that away from people.
Yeah. I think that it will be important, and an important question for a large percentage of New Zealanders, especially ones that are religious. I think that it's more, this something like this is outweighed more by self-determination. You see, which we would move on from a con and make that a pro. I think that self-determination overpowers the like sanctity of life argument in a way. That's my opinion, because it's your life and you can choose what you want to do with it, especially if you are in pain in a way.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, yeah, when you look at it, it's pretty unethical for a state to determine decisions that directly impact someone's own autonomy to that extent, to say, hey, look, I think you need to be alive in the condition you're in, and no, you can't choose to take your own life. If you want to do it, it has to be a legal suicide, right?
Yeah. I mean, but that's another problem that we have, especially in New Zealand, when we see absolutely abhorrent suicide rates in the country. It's such a delicate argument, like self-determination to end of life, but then we've got this big suicide problem and a big youth suicide problem with depression and everything. And it's, I think, the main like antagonists to this bill are people that don't see how you can draw a line between ending your life ethically and in the right times and then ending your life with suicide. And it's hard. I can't draw the line myself.
Yeah. Yep. I totally agree. Interesting point. And I was going to save it for when I was going to talk through David Seymour's argument, but interesting to note that, and you talk about those abhorrent suicide rates that are extremely large. About 8% of those were people who wanted to die to control taking the end of their life based on some form of pain.
Wow.
And he kind of riddled it down to that and said, you know, that's a large amount of people that are dying outside the scope of a situation where they could be with their families, outside of the situation where it's controlled, in kind of grievous circumstances where it could be done a bit more formally and a bit more nicely through the state.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a really good point to notice, that if you have these like strict controls and you do it well and you have it for these people that are obviously in enormous pain that they just don't want to live anymore, I think that then self-determination is the overpowering factor and the most important thing. Like, this person is obviously in more pain than we can imagine. It's worse for them to carry on living.
Yeah. And so that's your final, or that's your big other pro, is the pain and suffering suffered by these terminally ill individuals that lead to circumstances where they can describe their life as worse than dying. To be alive is more painful than being dead to them. And it should therefore be utilized as, you know, some form of dignity to relieve that suffering and person in a position more comfortable position.
My question there, though, when we are finally coming around in this nice complete circle, is how do we quantify this person's pain and suffering? Do we quantify pain and suffering? How do we do it? Some person's idea of pain and suffering is different from others, obviously. Can maybe someone, like, say, I know this is an exaggeration, but someone who is being bullied at school and is having a terrible time might say, oh, I hate my life, it's not worth living, it's terrible. Like, people say that, and people are driven to suicide because of it, because they think that their life is painful and they're suffering. How do we quantify unbearable suffering?
I totally agree. And I'm, you know, I might be wrong here, but I've looked through the interpretation of the Act, and I can't find a strict definition for unbearable suffering. So maybe there's a bit of discretion given to the doctors on interpreting that, because we know that's a condition they have to be experiencing. Unbearable suffering that cannot be eased. So you're right. How do you quantify that? And that is a lot of pressure to place on a doctor to be able to, you know, interpret that. Okay, I suppose we've wrapped that up and we've talked about some kind of definition issues that we want to sort it out. I suppose my next thing is, can you kind of walk us through these countries that you've been researching, Joshy, and see if we can analogize them in any way to what's going on here in New Zealand under this bill?
Absolutely. So first we can look at the countries that have legalized it completely in both senses, euthanasia and assisted suicide. The Netherlands is very well known. Belgium is considered perhaps the most liberal. Belgium, Luxembourg, Canada, and Colombia also allow both euthanasia and assisted suicide. It interested me when I was looking around, and I mentioned this to you the other day, that assisted suicide is more widely available and legal than euthanasia. I think we determined this was because you are deciding to take your own life, whereas euthanasia is a controlled decision from other parties on whether to end your life or not, which is a lot more dubious, I would say.
Are you giving a lot more power to the state there? And obviously that is that's a deterrent because they don't want to have any, implications if anything goes wrong, or it needs to come from you.
Yes.
It's safer if it comes from you.
So these are the countries that I have: Switzerland, Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, Canada, and Colombia. And all of them, apart from Switzerland, both are legal. In Switzerland, euthanasia is illegal.
Again, I'm just going to say straight off the bat, that's, like we said with marijuana, that's not that many countries in the grand scheme of things.
Not at all, Richard, not at all.
David Seymour said 75% of New Zealanders want to see that happen. Want to see this euthanasia happen. How is it only legal in that many countries?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think that we can draw a few reasons from this. One, the World Medical Association deemed assisted suicide and euthanasia unethical for the doctor. So I don't know, maybe that influences Ministry of Health decisions or whatever, but that is quite an interesting stance on it altogether.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe we have quite a bad history with the negative connotations of euthanasia, for sure. And there are definitely negative connotations to do with it, especially in Europe, which would be the more classically liberal countries. So the answer is that I don't really know why. Do you have any reasons that you could think of apart from that?
No idea, Joshy. Tell me, because this is what interests me. Has anything gone wrong in these countries? Like, are things operating well over there? Is there any reason to be scared? I know a lot of the time, conservative MPs always push that these countries have become so liberal now, and that's where we're going to end up.
I don't think things have been a disaster. Euthanasia cases in Belgium, which is the most liberal country, and I'll just go back into the specifics of their bills a little bit later, but euthanasia cases rose from about 1,807 in 2013 compared with 1,400 in 2012, 700 in 2008, and 235 in 2005. So this is quite a small amount of people still. It's not gone crazy. This is the most liberal country in the world, and you still only have 18,000 people a year that are subject to this bill. And just over half of the cases last year were age 70 or over. I'll just go back into the specifics slightly. And that is that most countries also reflect characteristics of the bill in New Zealand, where they require an age of 18. This is in Belgium, there's no age requirement. The required diagnosis, some have none. No, most have no required diagnosis, which is interesting. That sets it apart from New Zealand. Only Colombia recognizes that there has to be a terminal phase before you're allowed to do it.
Right, so that is pretty liberal.
Yeah, very liberal. The symptom state, I'm just going to go to refer to Belgium as it's probably the most extreme here, is medically futile condition with unbearable mental or physical suffering.
Right, yeah. So you, if you, mental or physical, so you could have a very bad case of depression or a very bad case of some mental form and your physical body be completely fine and you'd meet that criteria.
Yeah, it appears so, which... Remind me, is that the case in New Zealand?
No. So the case in New Zealand is a terminal illness that's likely to end within 6 months. And you have to have significant ongoing decline in physical capability. So just from that physical capability requirement, you can tell it's not anything to do with psychological factors.
It's very interesting. I mean, considering that, you can see why it's done in our country due to, as we were talking before, the mental health state of a lot of people.
Yeah, you'd open the floodgates as soon as you made that liberal to, yeah.
And I'll just quickly cross to Switzerland here. Again, number of assisted suicides in Switzerland has risen more than fourfold in more than a decade, just over a decade. But I mean, these are still really small numbers. They're around 1,000 people. Swiss population is about similar to New Zealand, 5 million people or so. And they have currently 1,000 people assisted suicides a year. So it seems that there's quite a well-constrained build. No, not many people take advantage of it, but maybe the people that need it do actually now have access to it when they didn't before. It seems that it is remaining relatively controlled and is not getting out of hand by any means.
Oh, that's good to hear. Yeah.
There is one final thing that I think could be talked about. Is there a thing called suicide tourism? And this is when...
There's people traveling, right?
Yeah, people travel to these countries to be able to have access to assisted suicide. For instance, 221 people traveled from outside of Switzerland into Switzerland in 2018 to be able to have access to assisted suicide, which is interesting, and I'm not sure where the line is drawn here.
Yeah, so my first concern straight off the bat there is, if you're well enough to be on a plane or you're well enough to travel, but I mean, I'm of the fact that I suppose if it's in a regulated environment, they're going to kill themselves anyway. But yeah, that really interests me. Getting in a car and traveling to Switzerland to take your life, you know.
Yeah, just before we wrap up my section, I want to just bring us back to the World Medical Association. And it states, no physician should be forced to participate in euthanasia or assisted suicide, nor should any physician be obliged to make referral decisions to this end, which I think is quite interesting.
Okay, yeah, no, that interests me, because if you look at Section 5A of this bill coming through, it's exactly the same process. So a health practitioner is under no obligation to assist any person who wishes to exercise the option, and they can conscientiously object to providing that assistance if they seek that.
It's interesting. I think that also comes down to what this article continues to say, is that separately, the physician who respects the basic right for the patient to decline medical treatment does not act unethically. So I guess there are sort of a certain loopholes that doctors could get around by saying, oh, actually, this isn't unethical if I just sort of decline to withhold this unwanted care sort of act.
I suppose it would just be passed on to someone who's willing to perform that procedure. Okay, well, that leads us into these party lines, and I'll go through each of these two cases, or these two MPs, and we can talk back on either of them. So one of the strongest arguers against this bill coming to fruition is Simon O'Connor. And he's been pretty persistent, and he's kind of been a spokesperson against it. And he's got some videos on Facebook if anyone wants to check them out, where he does little panels and talks about it.
Simon O'Connor is in the National Party?
Simon O'Connor is in the National Party, yep. Okay. He argues that the current laws as they stand mean no one will die against their will, but under the proposed law change, involuntary deaths suddenly become possible. He believes that a blanket ban is the only way to ensure that the most vulnerable members of society are protected. He brings up the fact that any submission and arguments against current laws essentially rely on emotional experiences and intense ideologies. And he doesn't believe these are the best foundations for building laws. While they are important, they do not and they do deserve to be heard, they can't be the foundation for a law change, under his opinion. He said one person's suicide affects many other people, some directly more than indirectly, and it makes a statement about one's sense of self-worth. But it also makes an explicit statement about the worth of others living with the same or a similar condition and where they deserve to be.
I think that this comes back to the pros and cons we were discussing before. And he makes some good arguments for the cons that we were talking about. That how do you separate this suicide and need for assisted dying? How do you draw the line between them? This is a big problem. I think that he sort of doesn't think on like weighs two sides, and the fact that he is saying that the pros are all, ideology, have a strong ideology, but he's probably also coming at it from maybe a religious standpoint. I'm not sure if he's religious, or like a sanctity of life standpoint, which is also ideology in a sense. So I'm not sure if you can make that argument explicitly, but I think that his argument on drawing the line between each other's self-worth is an important thing to contemplate. And I think that they have started to contemplate this when they've been drawing up the final readings of the bill.
I totally agree on the ideology front. I mean, some of the best laws we've ever seen come to fruition in this country have come from emotion and intense ideology. Take homosexual law reform. That wouldn't have come forward without people advocating on their own personal emotional experiences of not being able to get married and certain things like that. So yeah, to say you can't build laws on that is a bit touch and go there. The involuntary death's possible. I do respect that argument, and I understand where that is coming from. So he brings up a story. He brought up a story in Parliament, and apparently it was pretty emotive and kind of resonated with a lot of people. And this is a situation that happened in the Netherlands. And what I suppose a lot of MPs like to do is they will bring up the bottom end of the slope, right? You take the worst example to kind of advocate that you never get on that train in the first place. So he goes on to talk about an elderly woman with dementia in the Netherlands. So this woman had previously said she'd like to die by assisted dying years ago. And a couple of years later, the family takes her in. They put drugs in her tea initially to sedate her. And she wakes up in the middle of an injection. And the family were actually forced to hold down this woman while she was screaming, no, 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 and administered the injections. So The Hague ruled that the doctors, that these kind of doctors can administer euthanasia in patients with advanced dementia if the patient had earlier made a written directive. So yeah, he argues on this and said that's where New Zealand's going to head if this law comes through.
I mean, yeah, he's making the assumption on the slippery slope. But I mean, this is why these strong provisions have been put in the bill, the 6 months, etc. I think that obviously that is would be a horrible thing to watch as a family. And also we don't know if maybe she was in her right mind at that point or she was dementia. And those are things that I would say she shouldn't have been euthanized. I would say personally, I don't think
I totally agree. I have no doubt in my mind someone that wakes up in the middle of it, obviously is uncomfortable with the process going in place, doesn't understand it, should not be receiving euthanasia in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, which I think is why, yeah, it's important to have these restrictions. It's important to understand where we should be going and what this is technically really what this is for. And that is to basically have prevent people from going through insufferable pain.
I suppose his last argument, and we've talked over his two and we've kind of spoke to the involuntary deaths and we've spoken to the emotional experiences. His last thing was obviously, and same with Bill English, is talking about making one sense of self-worth less than another's. And again, I feel like with any argument, you can link it down to stringent regulation, right? It's a very minuscule class of people that fit all those criteria that we've laid out.
Yeah, and the growth isn't even that large in the countries that have legalized it, right? There is such a stringent control on the people who can access it that maybe more people that are like suitable will take advantage of it, but it won't leach out into the wider community. I think the statistics show that. And yeah, we have these odd cases, these outliers where it's obviously unethical what has happened, or obviously it's not good what has happened. But I think that the bills that have been passed in these countries have remained pretty strong in venting and keeping restrictions on the people who actually need it.
So obviously Netherlands in this case is an outlier. And I mean, I don't know strictly, I did read up on it and it did happen and this case did go to The Hague. But yeah, definitely an outlier, and he's focused on a pretty dark example there. But I mean, important to bring up these factors. But yeah, so that leads us on to, and I figured the easiest way to do this was let's talk about the guy that introduced the bill. So I've got on the other side of the argument you're strongly for in David Seymour. Now, he's got a few arguments here, and he's also got another story, so a story on the other side, which is quite fun to analogize them. He's pretty much said a person at the end of their life suffering badly and unable to be helped by palliative care, I should say, can commit amateur violent suicide. We know from extensive studies of the records of this country that 5% to 8% of New Zealand suicides were by people who were dying and wanted to take control of the end of their life and were in some form of pain, as we were talking about before. Another option is that 4.5% of New Zealanders who die under informal euthanasia in New Zealand currently. So they're given pain medication with the express intent of ending their life, but it somehow fits into legislation. So it's a bit of a grey area, and I know doctors feel, from what I've read, a bit uncomfortable doing it, but currently you can get around it by giving medicine that speeds up someone's death. And he goes on to say, it's wrong in 2017 under the laws made by this house that we tolerate a status quo where people suffer needlessly. We allow our laws where there is violent amateur suicide, barbaric suffering, and informal euthanasia, what we were talking about before, which are all perfectly legal, but the choice we don't give to the person. And it's in question them who are suffering at the end of their day, of their life, and it should be them who's making this choice.
I just want to ask Richard, on the role of palliative care. It is often argued that pain and suffering experienced by patients can be relieved by administrating appropriate palliative care, making euthanasia a futile measure.
He essentially said that there's 4.5% of New Zealanders who die through informal euthanasia, given this pain medication with the express intent of ending their life by these doctors. But at the same time, we don't allow them that right to choose to die, but we're still doing that in the same place. He said it kind of feels a bit like there's blurred lines.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so I suppose that kind of comes down to hypocrisies in the medical industry, right? So you've got a process of palliative sedation where you place patients in a sedative state until they die, and it's actually recognized in New Zealand's palliative care handbook as inducing relief of suffering and increased hastening of death. And because it's the pragmatic argument, isn't it? Because it's essentially being carried out already in an informal sense, why isn't it that it shouldn't be legalized and regulated appropriately?
Yeah, I think that we have this problem with a lot of things, especially in New Zealand. I mean, abortion was another thing until very recently that could be recognized as like a similar problem, where we have this quite gray area and this thing where the doctors are sort of moving around and are moving around the issue a bit.
You're completely right. And that's usually and a good indication that a law isn't working.
Absolutely.
So with abortion, we had doctors essentially lying that their patients had medical health problems to push abortions through.
Yeah. And so you think if this doctor sees this operation as necessary, and probably the most overwhelming majority of doctors in these situations do, like an abortion, most doctors would pass it and sign off these things for women to get abortions. In this case, obviously, it's probably quite similar. They're like, well, this is the best course of action to go. Then if this is the case, then who is the government to regulate the decisions of medical professionals in a way?
Yeah, so I think that's a really strong argument from David. And also, as we were talking about, that 8% of New Zealand's suicides by people who are dying and wanted to take control of their life and pain, that's another big stat for me. And that's, that's unregulated death that could be done in safer condition.
Yeah, and less painful for families.
Yeah, so on the other side of the argument, David Seymour brings up a story, and I knew we were talking about this story from the Netherlands, so it's kind of cool to analogize this one. But Miss Seals was a Wellington public lawyer, and she was diagnosed with a brain tumor in 2011. She unsuccessfully argued in the High Court that she was entitled to assisted dying. So she pointed out to hypocrisies in our system of law. She was in quite significant pain with this brain tumor. But she argued that the law was contradictory, and that by depriving her of the opportunity to bring her suffering to an end, the state was subjecting her to cruel, degrading, or disproportionately severe treatment, which is a right affirmed under the Crimes Act, a thing that is illegal for the state to do. Quite an interesting point there. And so she went on to kind of argue for this. And she became kind of an advocate and a story that a lot of MPs have used as a reference. And she ended up obviously dying of natural causes outside of this process and experienced pain because of that. And she believed dying under these conditions was the only safe way of alleviating her suffering.
Yeah. And so this is the self-determination that we come back to that is really important. I just want to bring up something that I found in the Swiss law is that Switzerland permits assisted suicide if the person assisting the suicide acts unselfishly. And I think this is really important because it comes back to self-determination. And like, obviously, she thought that this would be just better than continuing to live and safer and nicer for obviously her family. And what there was a quote from her, Richard, what did it say?
So she's gone on to say, "I, Lucretia Seals, a human being confronted with inescapable reality of my death and the prospect of great suffering, for me and those who love me, must have the right to determine when I have reached the end of the road. This right belongs to me and no one other." You know, and that's her. That's as you say, that is pretty much a decision coming purely from her in relation to a situation that only she's in and only she understands. And she doesn't think it's the state's right to tell her, no, you can't do this.
No, who is it, the state's right or our personal ideological right to determine whether she should suffer through pain that she deems worse than death? But also, Richard, at the end of the day, this is a decision in September that comes down to your ideology in a lot of ways. It comes down to your personal belief. I think more so than cannabis that we talked last week, because there is factual things on either side, arguments on either side. I think here, this is a much more sort of ideological and personal belief-based argument, right?
Yeah, you're completely right. And I think, you know, you can take a bit of refuge in the fact that all these polls have significant leads to legalizing. So I've got four up here now, and 65%, 70%, 72%, 74% of people voting for. I don't think this isn't going to go through.
I think that, yeah, I think that it should go through personally. And I think that the way it's written is a good, safe way to first introduce it to the public. But I think that if you do have religious objections or personal beliefs that contradict this, I don't think that it is a wrong stance to have in a way. I think that you can have those beliefs and vote no, and there is no real argument against it, really. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so no, and as I say, it's obviously important that we offer those avenues for doctors that aren't willing to do this or don't agree with that this process to be able to get out of it. And I understand that if it's obviously the sanctity of life is a huge concept in religion, and you know, a lot of people also bring down to the fact that as soon as one person's dying that fits a certain condition, a lot of other people are going to feel forced into that. And I think all those arguments are valid.
It all comes down to respecting that person's self-determination, I think, and not letting anyone else come in and influence the decision and say, well, this, because this happened, you also need to go through that. It all comes back to asking the person, especially in New Zealand's case, when it's not much of a mental decision, a mental health decision yet, it's all coming down to like tangible pain in a sense, not trying to undermine pain felt by mental health, but like physical pain. And so then you can really come and approach each case individually, approach each person and ask if this is the way they want to go. And I think that's the crux and how it has to function all the time. It has to come back to the individual. After examining all the restrictions, and after they pass all this and then you ask, is this what you want? And it has to be the person's decision and their decision alone.
So I mean, all these counter arguments and these prevalent risks, because there are prevalent risks, and as we talk about slippery slope and everything, and the only way of mitigating those risks regarding active voluntary euthanasia is through stringent regulation. And we've kind of outlined, it's a lot of hoops to jump through. Absolutely. I don't think a lot of people are going to be able to prove that not only their suffering from a terminal illness that's going to end in 6 months, but they're also experiencing unbearable suffering. And on top of that, that it's an informed decision coming from them. It's a lot. And yeah, as you say, that final one is so important, that self-determination and that individual autonomy, saying, look, this is me. This isn't my family. This isn't my children who are over having me in the house. This is coming totally from me, and I don't want to be alive anymore.
So, yeah, I think that almost wraps us up. I think that it would be important for us maybe just to sum up what could go wrong and what can go right. Also, could be interesting to leave people with a few questions to ask themselves before they vote. For instance, I have a few agonizing moral dilemmas written down here. And that is it ever right to end the life of a terminally ill patient who is undergoing severe pain and suffering, which we have talked about, and we have discussed our views, but it is something to take home and with yourself. Another would be, under what circumstances can euthanasia be justifiable, if at all? You can think about that and measure it up to the bill and see if it lines up with what you're thinking. And another would be, is there a moral difference between killing someone and letting them die?
Are all big questions, really big questions that people need to kind of ask and gloss over before they go into that voting booth room, because it can be, you know, it could be quite an intimidating sight to see with yes or no, and you haven't done your background research and thinking. A big ups to the referendums.govt.nz website that lays out both cannabis and euthanasia pretty well on there if you need some kind of more information than we've provided as to kind of what direction you want to vote. But yeah, those are big questions, Josh. Like, even hearing them now, it's just like, yeah, that's not an easy thing to gloss over.
It's not at all. But I think it is really important to think about them and think about your personal view on them. And there's no wrong view on them, in my opinion. And just see if the bill measures up to your personal beliefs. And like, if it doesn't, don't feel pressured to do it. I mean, I believe that there are definitely people that this can help. And there, I'm personally fully for it, and I believe that it will help a lot of people and it will mitigate a lot of pain for a lot of people. But I think that, like, don't compromise your belief systems to vote for it if you don't.
Yeah, great understanding. Great. And it's quite interesting that and you'll notice I think it's Judith Collins. There's a few MPs that didn't agree with this until they had one of their parents going through, you know, intense suffering and intense pain. And, you know, it didn't align with their value systems, but kind of when you see it up front, you're suddenly like, whoa, you know, they don't deserve to be going through that.
Absolutely.
But it is crazy. And you're right in the sense that at the end of the day, this is a vote that comes down to you.
So do you think that they're, just very, very quickly, you could underline your biggest pro and biggest con of this bill.
Actually, Joshy, my pro and cons are pretty similar, because my pro on this is that David Seymour and, you know, kind of refinement within the house has left this to quite a small class of people, and therefore all those slippery slope arguments get mitigated, right?
Yeah.
But then my con might be that maybe not enough people have access to it. So it comes from the same fact. I generally think it's quite a bit of hoops to jump through, and I'd hate to see someone that's in pain, that's maybe got a year or 2 years left to live, doesn't have access to these services.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because you could have probably like the same sort of illness with maybe even more pain, and you could have more than 6 months to live. And is that actually probably worse? You'd have to go through years of this pain instead of 6 months of this pain.
Yeah, wait till you come in that 6 month period that you've been given just to meet within the, you know, restrictions of this act.
Yeah.
I think another good thing about it, another pro, is that it doesn't put too much blurred lines on doctors and physicians making these decisions. I think it's pretty clear who meets it and who doesn't. So there's not that kind of pressure and discretion that they have to exercise on the front lines. I think that's quite a big benefit.
Yeah, I think there will be, when after this bill is passed in a few years, there will be revisions and there will be changes to it. Just generally because I think it is, in some ways, doesn't tackle some areas. For instance, I think it was smart to leave out the mental health problem in this first bill, because it is an extremely complex problem, especially in New Zealand. but it is something that will eventually need to be tackled itself. So maybe that's not a pro or a con, but it is something to bear in mind as well for future.
Right. And obviously, on to you, man. You looking and thinking about all that we've talked about today, can you think of two big, or big pro and a big con coming through this legislation?
Yeah, I think I agree with you on the con that you brought up, is that maybe it is very restrictive. And I think that there could be a case where we hardly see anybody utilize it in New Zealand every year. I think it would be a very, very small amount of the population. I mean, people that deserve to use it, but I think it would leave out people that potentially could also need it. And I think it could apply to ethically. My pro would be, it's something that I personally believe in. And I think that it is something that needs to be pushed forward. And I think that it's really good that it's happening and that it's coming into the conversation, whatever, and it's being accepted as something in the law at all is very, very cool.
Yeah, just to wrap up, interesting thought. I just Googled when Lucretia Seals actually died. So her case was in the High Court in 2011 with her brain tumor that was causing her severe pain. She didn't die until 2015. Wow. So she wouldn't have met these conditions straight off the bat. Something that actually, you know, and big ups to her. Her argument, you know, promoted, and David Seymour said it's been a big fact pushing him to make this happen. But yeah, she wouldn't have met those conditions.
That's really interesting, actually. Well, I think that's a good part to wrap up this conversation before we start rambling off on too many tangents or getting into too many parts where we start making a few mistakes or misstatements. Thank you, Richard, for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure, never a chore. As always, if you have any information that you yourself have or opinions, don't forget to message us or leave a comment. Follow us. We're on SoundCloud, Spotify, and YouTube under the Two Redheads.
I enjoyed researching that. It was cool. It was cool to look into, and obviously there's a lot of stories either side of the argument and a lot of people that have experienced some pretty tough stuff. So no, it was a cool thing to research into.
As always, we encourage you to do your own research and make your own informed decisions. Emphasis on the informed. Think about your personal beliefs and who this could help or affect the passing of the bill. And yeah, stay safe out there. Thanks for joining us.
Cheers, guys.